You're listening to More Perfect Marketing, the show for business owners and entrepreneurs always on the lookout for smart marketing ideas to keep their business moving forward. And now, here's your host, David Baer.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of More Perfect Marketing. It's David Baer here, and there is a word that I use all the time when I'm talking to marketers, when I'm talking to business owners. And it describes what I think very few marketers or business owners think about when they think about marketing. It's relationships. How do you create relationships with those you're wooing, you're prospecting, you're trying to get to become a customer, client, or patient? And how do you view the relationship once they do become a customer, client, or patient? And how do you build on that relationship? These are conversations I have sometimes with myself, but usually with other human beings on a regular basis. And as I was looking through today's guest's website and the materials that he shared with me before we met up today, I realized this is a word that is central to a lot of what he does and what he talks about as well. And to help sort of expand upon this idea, I'm so thrilled to have Craig Andrews, who's joining me from the great, very large state of Texas today. Craig, welcome.
David, thank you for having me. I've been looking forward to this. So good to be here.
Well, brilliant. I said relationships, but we're going to get to that in a little bit. But as I was sort of thinking about what you do today, there's a story that I know you share quite a bit, which gives a little bit of background on this idea that's sort of core, that's central to the work that you do. And I wonder if we can kick things off a little bit by sharing that story, because it's not one that is typically related to marketing, but it's a very personal one.
It is personal. And it's, you know, it's interesting. Right now, I 2 years ago, I was, you know, in the hospital. I was getting ready to get out. I'd been in for 3 months. But I went in August 10th, 2021, and 11 days later, they shot me up full of morphine and then called my wife in the middle of the night and said, "Hey, your husband's having trouble breathing. We think we should put him on the ventilator." And I had COVID. It was the Delta variant of COVID. And the formula was, if you went on the ventilator with Delta variant, you died. And in fact, that's what they told my wife. They said, this is what's going to happen. He will die. They had her meet with hospice to plan the day they were going to pull the plug. And it was lights out for me. But I spent 6 weeks in a coma. Obviously, the doctors were wrong. It's not the first time. It won't be the last. And the doctors were wrong. But one thing that was really interesting was when I woke up 6 weeks later, my trust in the doctors had plummeted, while my trust in my wife had just absolutely skyrocketed. It had gone through the roof. And it was interesting. When I woke up, my brain was scrambled. It took me another 2 weeks to even have some semblance of clear thinking. And the doctors would come around. They'd want to do something. And at this point, I was just acting on instinct. You know, and we all act on instinct. And my instinct said, don't trust them. Whatever they asked to do, say no. And so I'd tell them no. And they would go talk to my wife and they'd say, Mrs. Andrews, we want to do such and such. And she would come to me and say, hey, the doctors want to do this. And I'd ask her, is it safe? And she'd say, yeah. I'm like, okay. And so that's how it went. And it was really interesting. During the 6 weeks of my coma, my trust in the doctors had plummeted. It just dropped through the floor, while my trust in my wife went through the roof. And about 2 weeks after I woke up, I started realizing some of the things I believed about the world were not true, or at least people around me had a different view of the world than I did. And so I called my wife over to the side of the bed and I said, I'm going to tell you some things. I need you to tell me if they really happened. And one started off about some wild story of me being at a resort in Louisiana, convalescing. I knew I'd been sick. And I was there getting better, and they would spray raw cow's milk at my face, and it would make me feel better. It was part of the room service at the resort. I kept hitting redial, get more cow's milk. It just made me feel better. And she's like, no, that didn't happen. And I was like, and I kept on telling her a little bit more about my memory. And I said, well, at one point you came in the room and you put your hand on my shoulder and you said, Craig, this is Karen. I'm your wife. It's going to be okay. And she sat back and she said, Craig, I said those exact words to you when you were in your coma. And as I left the hospital and I started piecing together, and you know, in many ways, I'm still trying to piece together exactly what happened, you know, some of the parts of 6 weeks of my life that I'm missing. But as I left the hospital, I kept thinking about that. And what I realized was while I was in my coma, I was still taking in messages. I was taking in messages from the medical staff. I was taking in messages from my wife. And it hit me that it was like Maya Angelou's quote, people will forget what you said, they will forget what you did, but they will never forget how you made them feel. Hmm. And the way, while the doctors were speaking words of death and despair in my presence, my wife was speaking words of life and hope. And in 6 weeks of being unconscious, it absolutely polarized my trust in my wife versus my trust in the doctors. And as I started thinking about it, you know, I was like, well, we do this thing called first time offer. It's kind of like a mini project. It's exclusively for people that do high ticket sales. It helps them close more deals faster at higher prices. And I was thinking about that. I was like, oh my goodness, this is another reason why they work so well. It comes back to that Maya Angelou quote. And it turns out when you come along somebody shoulder to shoulder in life and help them solve a problem, even a small problem, it changes the way they feel about you. It actually releases oxytocin in the body, which is oxytocin's the bonding hormone that bonds baby to mother. It's a powerful hormone. And in the same way that I felt bonded to my wife coming out of my coma, even more than before, when we take folks through first-time offers or our clients take them through first-time offers, that bonding effect is there as a part of the process. And there's just so much trust that's built during a very short period of time. And that's why they can close more deals faster and they can close them at higher prices.
I mean, a fascinating place for you to come to from the experience that you had. But I think to a certain extent, we all, you know, apply what's relevant in the rest of our lives to whatever situation we're in. And maybe, you know, maybe that's what happened there. But it got me thinking as you were sharing the story and about the sort of impulsive reaction to some of the things that the medical team was suggesting to you that you would say no. It reminded me of the Daniel Kahneman book, Thinking Fast and Slow, about the two different systems that we have for addressing things that are presented to us. And I think I'm curious, you nodded. So sounds like you know the book and understand sort of the different approaches to the way that we think about stuff. I'd love to dig into this idea of a first-time offer and how someone who is a prospective client of a business interacts with and reacts to the things that are presented to them, similar to the way that you were in that story. Would you mind walking us through that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, for those that aren't familiar, and I'm going to use, you know, super dumbed down talk, you know, in the fast and slow.
Yeah.
I divide the brain into two halves. Obviously, there's a little more complexity there, but from a simple approach, there's the decider part of the brain, which is the back part of your brain, makes 95% of your decisions. And there's the explainer part of the brain, the frontal cortex, only makes 5% of the decisions, but it's responsible for explaining 100% of the responses. And so a lot of the decisions that we make are based on, you know, we're relying on our instinct is one term that's used for it. I look at it as our brain is a pattern recognition. The system one is a pattern recognition system that's looking for patterns. It separates safe patterns from dangerous patterns and compels the body in the direction of safe. And so, you know, where I would draw the analogy to what I experienced, I mean, messages absolutely were coming through. I mean, I gave you an example of one, and I call them dreams. And that's only because I lack a better word for what they were. It's sort of a middle state between consciousness and unconsciousness. Mm-hmm. But I could go through dream after dream. I've been able to map dreams to specific times in my wife's journal, because she journaled on Caring Bridge the whole time. And so the one thing that's abundantly clear is messages were coming through to my consciousness, even though I was unconscious. When somebody tries to sell, your body language changes. You know, maybe you're leaning a little bit more forward, or you're doing something else, but your body language changes and your customer has the same pattern recognition system working in their head. And as soon as they see what I call the unspoken language of sales, their guard goes up, because people don't want to be sold. They're like, whoa, wait a minute, you're trying to sell me. What are you doing? And that's when the instinctive part, you know, tying back to what you asked about, you know, where I would just tell the doctors no. Well, guess what? The easiest thing to say to a sales pitch is no, you know, because it's protecting yourself. It kicks in a few cognitive biases, a big one about preserving autonomy and avoiding irreversible decisions. And so we do that. And so one of the problems with sales is your body language changes when you're selling, and your customer picks up on it and puts them on guard during a time that you're really trying to get them relaxed and trusting. Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious sort of how this first time offer concept that you've shared with us a little bit, or you've dangled in front of us, but we don't yet know what it is, I guess.
Yeah.
How that comes into play in addressing some of what we've just been discussing, because ultimately the trust piece, and I use the word relationship, but I think trust is probably more central to this than relationship, although relationship comes from trust, perhaps. How that trust piece is addressed, that's the word I'm looking for, through this scenario of the first time offer. What, walk us through sort of what that all means, what it looks like, and what the experience is from the perspective of, I guess, both sides, the business and the prospective client.
Yeah. And you know what? It may be easier if I throw out a couple examples that people can kind of lock into. So years ago, Columbia House Records had this deal: buy 13 albums for a penny. So if you're the type of person that wants to build a record collection, they will get you 13 steps closer to your goal for one penny. Pretty good deal. We would call that a simple offer. If you're doing high ticket sales, that type of offer won't work. Trust me, I've tried. You need a complex offer. So here's an example of a complex offer, not one that we designed, but one that everybody understands, can relate to, and it makes an interesting point. So years ago, there was a guy named, oh my goodness, I just drew a blank. I mean, I've almost got his name tattooed on my body.
Well, tell me the offer, and then I'll probably know exactly who you're talking about.
His name is Bob Stupak.
Okay, sure. Sure, the Vegas hotel guy.
Vegas hotel guy. Yeah, he bought some dumpy old hotel at the end of the Vegas Strip. Today, you would know it as the Strat or the Stratosphere. And he wanted to turn it into a player on the Strip. And so he ran this deal. He said, give me $396, and I will give you 3 days and two nights in one of my deluxe suites. When you arrive, there will be a bottle of champagne waiting for you in your room. All of your drinks on property are free, whether you're gambling or not. Even if you're sitting in one of our entertainment lounges, you pay nothing more for your drinks. And not only that, but for your $396, I will give you $600 of chips to use in my casino. So that's what we would call a complex offer. It has four deliverables. And if you're the type of person that likes to drink and gamble, it's hard to say no to that offer. Mm-hmm. Free booze and free casino chips. Turns out that people that like to drink and gamble were Bob Stupak's most profitable clients. And so he wanted the hotel filled with people like that. If you're like me, I'm not a gambler. I drink wine, but he probably wasn't offering the wine that would get me excited. And so his offer wasn't particularly compelling to me, which was good because he didn't want me staying in his hotel. He wanted more profitable customers there. So that's kind of the concept. It's something to bring people into your world in an irresistible way. And so when we do these, and I'm just going to talk in the context of service businesses. If it's a B2B service offer, almost always we price them at $497. There's some reasons for that. One, anybody with any decision-making authority in an organization can spend $500 without permission and without fear that anybody will ever ask them how that money was spent. As a matter of fact, we're bringing on an enterprise client that just has like this insane vendor approval process that they say it takes 35 days. We're at like 40 days in the process. And if you think about somebody thinking through, do I want to bring on a new vendor and they have to go through this process every time? They're going to be darn sure that that you're going to be somebody that will work, you know, for them, that you'll be a good vendor to them before they start that process. So $497, it makes it stupid simple, especially when you're delivering about $5,000 of value for that $497. And it has to solve a problem. And this is where some of that bonding that I'm talking about, you use the word relationship. When you come alongside somebody in life and you solve a problem, even a small problem, it causes the uncontrolled release of oxytocin in the body. It's a bonding hormone, incredibly powerful. And so it has to solve a problem, which, by the way, a audit doesn't solve a problem. That just highlights the problems that are there. And you may say, no worries, we do an assessment. And an assessment is just a nice word for an audit. And so you actually have to solve a problem, but you want to leave the big problems unsolved. You want them to naturally advance to the next step. We found that it should have 4 or 5 deliverables. And at least one of those deliverables should be the product of a co-working workshop where the client, the prospect, walks away feeling like it was their ideas that made the final cut on that. Mm-hmm. You know, and so your job is to kind of put up the bumper guards and make them roll the ball down the alley.
So you guide them, but you know where you're guiding them. You have the control to get them to where they were going to get inevitably anyway. Is that sort of the point?
Where you want them to be. So, yeah. And this, and I'm trading off complexity versus ease of explanation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the things, there's a couple reasons for that. Let me say 3 reasons. One is it triggers a couple cognitive biases. It triggers the IKEA effect. It triggers the endowment effect, where they value that work product more highly than it probably should be valued, you know, because they put effort into it and it's something they have ownership. So that's the first reason. The second reason is it's their ideas. For them to not move forward with their own ideas would require that they reject their own ideas, which is kind of unlikely. And the third reason is anytime you're trying to close a deal, almost certainly your prospect has a broken belief system. And until you change the belief system, they won't become a prospect. And some belief systems are too hard to change during a sales call. Actually, I would say impossible. So when you're guiding them in this direction, you're trying to guide them to a revelation, sort of a self-revelation of, I never saw the world this way. Mm. Oh my goodness. I now see why this is right. And everything I've been doing in the past was wrong. When you achieve that, you're now the sole source supplier for what they're doing.
I just want to stop there for a moment, because this is key that I hope our listeners pick up on. What you've just described is something we talk about a lot, which is asking the question, what does the prospect need to believe before it's appropriate to extend the offer or present the offer to them? Because as you said, if they don't have that shifted belief, the likelihood of them saying yes or converting is going to be much, much lower. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah. And so, you know, and in the final deliverable, we say it has to solve a problem That's a new problem that's uniquely created by the successful delivery of the preceding deliverables. Okay. Okay, that sounds really complicated. Let me give an example that will simplify it. If you're buying a boat, you have a new problem. Actually, you have a lot of new problems, but let's talk about the fun one. You need a place to dock your boat. And so if I was selling boats and somebody came onto my boatyard, I would say, you know what? We're going to find the perfect boat for you. But once you find this boat, you're going to have a new problem. You're going to need a place to dock it. Well, guess what? We have relationships with all the marinas in the area, all the yacht clubs in the area. We know their prices. We're going to help you find the perfect place for you. We will make the introductions. As a matter of fact, if you want, we will have your boat delivered directly to your slip. So all you have to do is you and your family grab the picnic basket, grab the cooler, walk onto your boat and have an amazing day. When we do that, we're shifting their perspective from a perspective looking forward to the sale to already picturing after the sale.
Sure.
And, you know, at that point, it's going to be kind of hard to not sell them a boat.
Mm-hmm.
So those are kind of the elements. And what we found is when we do that and we pull that together, it's what happens once we deliver the, you know, the deliverables and we have a short call where we review it with them. They're usually saying, what's next?
Yeah.
How do we get started? So they're closing themselves. Now at the front end of this, when we're presenting the offer, I say present because we're not selling the offer. Remember I said, as soon as you start to sell, your body language changes. It's not, unless you're a bona fide sociopath, you can't control that. And so the way we make it easier to sell is we take people out of sales mode. We say, your job is not to sell, your job is to present.
Yeah.
The offer is simply a filter. You know, it's structured. So if you put it in front of an ideal, you know, a qualified client, qualified prospect, they'll say yes. But you don't always know everything that's going on. We found that when we present, there's about half the people that say no for reasons that sometimes we know at the time, sometimes reasons we find out 6 months later of, yeah, we would have never closed that deal.
So what I didn't hear in there, and based on what you've just said now, it sounds like there may or may not be a discovery process that will demonstrate whether somebody is qualified fully. I mean, but that's like, where does that stuff enter into the process? Because as I heard you talking about this, I'm thinking, gosh, this requires a business to have a super dialed in idea of who they're serving. They have to articulate that effectively. And therefore they're only going to be talking to people who are qualified at least demographically. And so there's these other characteristics of whether the person's really, or the company is ready to buy or capable of buying, that has to get, you know, unveiled or revealed during a discovery process.
Yeah, no. And so, yeah, let me get our whole process. So we go from initial discovery call, 1 hour call. At the end of the call, they either buy our first time offer or they don't. And half the people do that. And roughly 80% of those advance to our core offer that buy that. So our call goes, we have about 30 minutes of questions where we're asking them about their business. And we do have some questions in there that if they answer those incorrectly, we don't extend the offer. As a matter of fact, I had that happen this morning. You know, one of the things we add, you know, we try to find out lifetime value. We find very few people know their lifetime value, but we coach them during the call to kind of guide it in. And then at some point we ask them, you know, if your lifetime value, like call I had this morning, if lifetime value of a customer for you is $250,000, how much of that lifetime value would you be willing to spend on customer acquisition? And he refused to answer the question.
Yeah.
And so I politely ended the call and never extended the offer.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, so we have some of that baked in there. But when we design the offer, and this is one of the reasons that you want to have 4 or 5 deliverables, it's a lot of it's kind of catering to your ideal client. One of the deliverables we actually designed to be a scarecrow. And the scarecrow is invisible to your ideal clients. They don't even see it sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Your non-ideal clients absolutely see the scarecrow and they're like, I want no part of that. And it kind of scares them away.
Mm.
And so there are elements in the offer that we put in there. The other thing is the we filter out tire kickers. When you're selling something, when you're delivering $5,000 of value for $500,
yeah,
and they can't move forward, usually it's because they're a tire kicker. They just need to get three quotes. You know, they had to get three quotes and they were hoping you would devote some of your good and precious time at putting a quote together for them.
Yep.
So
based on what you just said, it sounds like proposals or quotes are not part of the equation in the scenario.
You know what? That's a really good point. I haven't written a proposal since 2018.
Yeah.
And it's been glorious because I don't know what, you know, your listeners spend. I used to put like, to pull in a client, every single time I stepped up at bat, I was spending 15, 20, 30 hours to try to land a client. And my success rate just wasn't that good. It was like 20%. And, you know, you do the math, there's just not enough time in the day, you know, to close clients, at least in the way that I was doing it. And so right now we do a 1-hour call to figure out if we do a first time offer. And then during the delivery of the, you know, and half the people say no. So we just not wasted another minute on them. And then we invest, you know, about 5 hours, a little bit less than 5 hours into the delivery of the first time offer and get an 80% closing rate on that. And so we're saving a ton of time with better closing rates. Oh, and by the way, higher prices, because once you're in, you don't have to be price competitive. You no longer have to do the bidding game.
Sure. Because you have the trust and the relationship, just to circle back to those two words that we were using.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now here's a funny story about, again, qualifying clients. I get on the phone with somebody once or Zoom, and he has this project and he's like, you know what? It's fully funded. I'm in charge. I'm making all the decisions. You know, and so from a qualification standpoint, he's saying all the things that you would expect. You know, and you'd be like, check, 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 check. And we get to the end and I present the first time offer to him. And he says, hey, would you mind writing that up? I need to run it by some people for approval. Like, you need approval to spend $500? I thought you were the man. Yeah, obviously I don't say that out loud, yeah. But in his case, I think what he was doing, he was actually putting together a pitch deck to try to raise funding for something. And he was hoping I would give him a free marketing plan.
Yeah. And by the way, this is not the first time I've heard a variation on that story. If you think back to old Madison Avenue days, that's the way a lot of, you know, companies would get their ideas, was they'd, you know, have the dog and pony show from all the ad agencies. They'd like, you know, a few of the ideas, and then they would take them to whoever they awarded the contract to and said, oh, by the way, here's a few ideas that were pitched to us. Why don't you play around with these too?
Yeah. 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 It's, yeah. So all that's rearview mirror for me. Mm-hmm. I don't deal with any of that. And it's wonderful. And you know, it even filtered out one thing that I would have thought was hyper qualified. I had a former client. It was somebody we had taken from 18 million to 60 million in 18 months. You know, very successful.
Yeah.
He left that firm, went to another firm, said, Craig, we need help with marketing. And so I had lunch with he and his boss, and he said, can you put together a proposal? I said, well, we don't do proposals anymore. I said, we always do these little mini projects. He's like, okay, can you put the cost of that into the proposal? I said, no. I said, we wouldn't even know how to write the proposal until we do this mini project. And he looked kind of sad, and the meeting ended. And that was one time I questioned the system. Mm-hmm. I mean, this should have been a slam dunk. Somebody had made a ton of money for, he was advocating, and they didn't call us back. Well, I ran into him about 6 months later and I said, hey, whatever happened with your marketing? He said, oh, well, the president has a buddy that does marketing and we went with him. And like, oh, so back to your question about qualification. He was immensely qualified. There was a horse in the race I didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I couldn't beat that horse.
Yeah. Yeah, these things sometimes sneak up on us or never reveal themselves, as was the case there, until after the fact you find out about, oh, this is why I didn't win it, and you were probably right in not putting that proposal in his hands as a result. So, yeah. Well, listen, I want to take a couple of minutes before we wrap up to understand a little bit about the types of work that you do, who you serve, in terms of the types of clients you work with. We've gotten, you know, sort of some hints throughout it. And as I've been listening to this entire idea of the first time offer concept, I'm sort of curious about how it's built, what the framework is, how it's architected. And fortunately for our listeners, you actually have something that can show the answer to that and guide them through how to engineer their own. So I'd love to get to that as well. But tell us a little bit about your company and who you're serving.
Yeah, so we're a marketing agency. We work exclusively with people that have high ticket offers. Sort of the holy trinity of how we know we're talking to the right person is they have a high ticket offer with a long sales cycle that requires a high level of trust. And when those three come together, we have a formula that you know, is kind of magical for them. And usually, you know, so B2B service is a commonplace. The example I gave was a financial advisor, the person we took from 18 million to 60 million. That's B2C, obviously, but again, it's service, high ticket, super high trust.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing, you know, and I keep using the word trust. You use the word relationship. We can use those interchangeably. I'm good with that. You know, so somebody that if you need a, you know, a high trusting relationship to close a deal, we have a way of building that in like 2 weeks.
And this is the framework that you obviously have created and used in lots of different scenarios based on the range of stories that you've told. I'm curious, you know, sort of how can someone preview that? How can they get a sense of what that might look like for them?
So we have a couple gifts for your audience, and and one of them is a guide to help put together their own offer and avoid some of the mistakes I made, which were many. Yep. You know, it took me 18 months to sort of start getting it working. And so this guide hopefully will help you avoid some of the mistakes I've made. The second thing is we have 23 days access to a course that we do. You know, it's an online course. And just so you know, the reason we do 23 days is we know how this goes. We study people. You sign up for a free course, you're going to get to it next month, then the month after that, and a year later, you've completely forgotten about it. We want people to take this course. We want their lives to be changed. And so we found if we put a little 23-day limit on it, guess what? People show up and they just kind of burn through the course, which is great. We want it to change their lives. So they can get that at allies4me.com. That's spelled ALLIES, the number 4, ME.com/moreperfectmarketing.
Brilliant. And that's all one word, the more perfect marketing part.
All one word, all lowercase.
And I love the name of your business, Allies for Me, because I think it really speaks to what we've been talking about as well, which is that you are you know, working with and serving your clients as a partner, as an ally through the process. I'm making an assumption, I'm projecting that, but I'm guessing I'm pretty close.
Absolutely. We believe everybody needs an ally.
Yeah. Well, brilliant. Hey, Craig, this has been fabulous. I'm like curious to dig around and learn more about the first time offer. I'm going to be jumping in there and if I can find time in the next 23 days, I might go through that course as well. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your very personal story, as well as how it's sort of connected to a lot of the work that you're doing on behalf of the businesses you serve.
David, it's been a delight. Thank you for having me.
Indeed. Folks, you've been listening to More Perfect Marketing. If you know somebody who could benefit from the conversation you've just heard, and I'm pretty sure you do, please share this with them. Until next time, my name is David Baer. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to More Perfect Marketing. Now you can put what you've learned here into practice when you join the free listener community at mpmcommunity.com. That's mpmcommunity.com. When you join today, you'll receive David's collection of 26 smart marketing cheat sheets to help you master your marketing, plus additional business building training. So don't delay. Join us today at mpmcommunity.com. We can't wait to welcome you.